Good morning, Ron.
Hey, W, how are you?
Very good, how are you?
Yeah, really good, thanks. Really good.
You're two months out from moving to the Caribbean.
That's right. It's exciting times.
So you've been a PT. One of the most interesting parts of your story is that you went through a little development curve as a personal trainer that I believe every personal trainer should go to. Mm-hmm. When you talk about personal training or about career in general, too often people think that the starting point is where they have to stay for a long time. Most PTs believe that personal training is the end all be all. So you do sessions forever.
Yeah.
Whereas I highly disagree.
Yeah.
I truly believe that doing PT sessions is one of the most fundamental parts of your base as a personal trainer. Yet it's something you should not be doing for too long.
Yeah.
Because you get stuck, and the progression curve and therefore fulfillment as a trainer and as a person just stalls for most people, which I see all the time. You started out as a PT in a resort, it was?
Yeah, so I was in Australia, in fact, when I decided to get re-educated. I picked up a big shoulder injury from rugby. I wanted to leave the hospitality industry. So I took all the money that I'd saved in Australia and took myself back to basically be re-educated. Someone said to me along the line that I enjoy training, I enjoy food, why don't I make a living out of it? And I thought, actually, that sounds exactly what I would like to do. So I started reinvesting myself into becoming a personal trainer or becoming a coach. As you probably know, well, probably a lot of people don't know, as I'm quite a big nomad, born in South Africa. Family is French. Dad's family is English. So as a little grommet, brought back and forth to the UK, lived in the UK, lived in Australia, and currently living back in the UK. And as you've just started it off, I will be enduring living in the Caribbean for a little while. And I've got a fantastic opportunity to be living in Canada. So 2020 for me is going to be a very interesting year, with prospects no doubt will come from that. But training for itself, it's like you said, is a huge stepping stone as having a strong foundation. There's no ways I could have told you 9 or 10 years ago when I started that I would be in this position today. And what I do with a lot of people is I encourage people to go and try stuff out and see where their interests are. And like you've just demonstrated, PT is a terminology of kindergarten. You need that basis. You need to have a good base, a good learning foundation, and you need to go try shit out. Because if you don't try shit out, you're never going to know if it works. You need to go see if it works for yourself, works for your clients, works with your philosophy, and get a good grounding. Keep on educating yourself, keep on moving yourself forward, and then go to first grade. And then once you hit first grade, you do exactly the same thing. Now, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of people out there that think education is everything. And they educate, but don't put anything into practice. Now, it's a fine balance. I like terminologies a lot when it comes to training and to food, because my background is all about food. I trained as a chef, 18, 19. Didn't know what I was going to do after school. So I do use food a lot when I talk to people because I find it, I'm very passionate about it. And I'm the same with training. So knowledge is you learn and you need to practice. So I use the terminology of a barbell. So it's kind of like knowledge is on the left-hand side. So you get a barbell and you've got 50 kilos on the left, which you've just learned. Now you need to make the bar even. So the bar becomes even by practicing the knowledge. So you practice the knowledge and the bar becomes 20 on the one side, 20 on the other side. And you do repetitions with a barbell. You become good at 60 kilos. Once you become efficient at 60 kilos, you then go for more knowledge. The barbell gets heavier on the one side and you move the barbell over to the right. So it becomes repetition. You learn and you grow.
I like that metaphor.
Yeah.
Applied knowledge.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
Which I 100% agree on. Knowledge itself is quite useless. Education itself is quite useless. It just depends on the level of application and what you actually do with it. So loading a bar in an uneven manner will not get much training result.
Correct.
Very good point.
Yeah.
So you became a PT in Australia and moved to the UK.
Well, so that's what I did. But what I did to become a successful BT was I didn't take any wage or any earnings for the first 6 months. Because all I wanted to do is understand the best in the industry at the time. So I got qualified in a course that took six months to qualify, not a couple of weekends. And out of that 6 months, I got given a massive notebook that I had to complete. And the only way I can get that completed was by integrating with customers, integrating with people at gyms, and get signed off. So much of what I've done with the whole with my life is kind of ask questions and see what you get back in return. So I shot a few emails out to gyms saying, listen, I will count reps. I will clean toilets. I just want to be on the floor. Can I shadow some people? I got a response back from Vision Gyms in Australia. At that time, I was commuting back to Byron Bay in Sydney. So picked up a Vision Gym just off the coast of the east coast of Australia. And went down in Sydney. And what I was doing was I kind of integrated with both managers and I would spend some time on the floor. And then I got signed off little by little. I took that knowledge and I came back to the UK and I worked at a private resort and I based myself in Chelsea. I worked my arse off for a full year. I did 7 days a week. I was hungry at the time because I wanted to understand where I wanted to be and where I wanted to learn from. I then discovered through the networking who was the best to learn in the industry. CP came up. I took every money that I had at the time and I spent it on my first BioSig course. And today, I've never been astounded and overwhelmed with information in my life, not knowing what to do. But I kind of knew I was probably in the best room because I was so confused. And that kind of set me on a journey. So I took the blueprint about asking questions, who's the best in the industry, who can I learn from? And I send out as many emails as I can. And yes, I get no's or I get yeses. And that's kind of how I continue to learn and process. And I absorb information. I tested out what I feel is appropriate on my client basis that I feel I can get results from. And then I apply that knowledge. And then what tends to happen a lot of the time is by going through one door, five other doors open. And that's what I love about seminars and about education that I've grown into, because I was horrible at school, by the way. Horrible. Is that method. So going in to go and learn something and having an open mind and then five other doors open. And I normally walk out of a seminar and buying books that had nothing related towards the seminar because coaches that I've met there or the person giving the seminar has spoke about what they're reading, what their interests are. And it's normally something a little bit diverse. And that's how my past continued to be where I am today.
So after a couple of years in the resort, working in Chelsea, you then basically opened up your own gym, which is a common next step for many PTs. You work at a gym and then you have the dream of having your own gym. And then you open your own gym, which for you was about 5 years ago.
Yeah, it was a little bit of 5 years ago. The step in between that was I gave up Chelsea. I looked after a couple of families while I was at the resort because I knew education. I was educated and in food and in lifestyle. And they were quite powerful in the sense of business. So they wanted somebody that was on point, they could work with their team, with chefs that did a lot of travel. That gave me a bit of grounding. So obviously the next step was to open the gym. And then that was quite a big move for me because letting go of something that I had quite a lot of comfort. You know, I had two families I looked after. I had a small client basis at this resort that I was training people four times a week as a minimum, as a base. So to move, let that all go and start my own practice was exciting for me because I kind of like to do that in life. Never get comfortable, challenge yourself and move on. Set up the gym, which was, don't get me wrong, a fantastic part of my life, which was 5 years ago. It's taught me a lot. I put a lot of time's gone in, a lot of effort's gone in, a lot of money's gone in. And to anybody that's listened to this, I mean, having your own space is amazing, but please do understand that there's a lot of stuff that you will not know unless you get involved with it. It's a big time in money zapper, and you've got to be really in the long game for it and understand what you really want to do. It's not a short term fix that you feel like this is progression for me. So warning sign.
So more of an intermediate goal instead of an end goal.
Yeah.
The open your own gym and everything's going to just work itself out. Yeah. Definitely not. It started out as a pure PT gym, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And then you tried different business models, ending eventually up at like a consulting-based business, which is a business model I have been basically doing myself for almost 10 years, promoting in Heavily. And I'm happy to see it flourish.
Yeah.
In a few locations.
Yeah.
There's not too many yet that do it. I truly believe that in the next couple of years, it's going to be a business model that's going to be more popular than ever.
Yeah.
Because it provides a lot of upsides while limiting the downsides.
Yeah.
So it gives a little bit of insight how you applied a consulting-based approach to personal training.
So we, at the gym, we kind of wanted to progress into getting people more responsibility. So utilize the consulting principle where we've got a big space, it's 3,000 square foot. The client will get a consultation once a month. Program design protocols will be applied with nutrition. The client would then come and utilize the gym when the gym is open. There'll be an instructor that is in the gym that would give them advisory if they didn't understand something, or safety kind of situation. The model worked out really, really well because people that want to purchase PT would then purchase PT on top of that. There was a solid basis of a membership that was given, and the membership included the consultation, the program design, and obviously the email support. That gave me the freedom in the sense of kind of doing what I could in the gym. If I wanted to do more PT, if I wanted to concentrate on other parts of the business, I could. And the client has had the sense of responsibility to have their fulfillment. So they could take a program and fulfill it within 3 weeks, or they could take a program and fulfill it within 6 weeks. That's their ownership. So the ownership between having a PT is that you then need the due diligence of them turning up 4 times a week, 3 times a week, twice a week, or once a week. So their alliance is that, okay, you're signing up to this. It's your due diligence that needs you to be in the gym twice or 3 times a week. This is the protocol with training. This is the health protocol that we're going to do with nutrition and supplementation, if this is what you want to go down. And then they have a continuous support with emailing. So it worked. I think it's the best model to practice and the best model to move forward with. The other model that we started with was only training 4 times a week, and it was only PT at a semi-private model. So we did 4 people at a time. Then we did 6 people at a time. But what became unsustainable was that we had different coaches on the floor. And obviously with different coaches, you have different spices. And with different spices, you get different outcomes of the ingredients. And people were signing up for a certain ingredient list, and they weren't getting that fulfillment. So the quality of the semi-private session wasn't being following through. So we had to pull that back and give the client what they were asking for, and it was obviously quality over quantity. Because we didn't want to turn into a commercial gym where it just be a numbers game. We want to make sure that everyone's getting a consultation, that everyone's not missing a consultation, that they're getting measured how they want to get measured, they're getting a quality program that's designed for them. It's not just a generic cut and paste. And we really wanted to understand the client a lot more, because understanding the client a lot more gave us a much quicker result at the end of the day. So yeah, that was the model that we kind of enrolled, and it made the gym a lot richer. There's a lot more quality that was coming out of it.
So more results, which means more value for the client. And at the same time, numbers-wise, it was the best the gym has ever done.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah.
So which the logical next question is, why did you move on and step out of having your own gym and going back to being a nomad, the Caribbean, Canada?
Well, this is the thing, like I mentioned a little bit earlier. I don't, comfort for me isn't success. Like, success for me is to keep on challenging myself. Now, a lot of people say to me, question me, it's like, why? And the big question of why is I want to continue to educate myself, continue to push myself, because settling for me is not something that is, my fulfillment was the gym. If the gym was successful, it's at its peak. It's time to go. It's kind of understanding that I need a new challenge in life. I need to move myself forward. I've moved myself into a position where I can take a little bit of time out. I can re-educate myself in fields that I'm super interested in, like functional medicine, training, and put more, a bit more writing I want to do, a bit more content. And I want to educate a lot more people in an understanding supplementation or health supplementation, and getting people's knowledge out to making sure they can have better choices with the knowledge that I put out for them. So the fundamental thing is it's a new chapter of my life and I'm excited. And I've done this with other parts. I did this with the hospitality when I was a chef. I did this with playing healthy sports. I did this with becoming a trainer. And I think this is another great opportunity to take another bite of an apple and see where I turn out in the next 5 to 7 years and see what different avenues come from it, really.
So the main stream of income right now is basically you're distributing and selling supplements online.
That's correct, yeah.
So you started that almost the same time as you started the gym, about 4 years ago. The online shop started and you grew it since then?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a story that I didn't think that I would be telling as of today. And that purely came down from making a few purchases, buying a few extra stock. A couple of trainees found out that I was holding a couple of extra stock, dropped me a few text messages. I would then reinvest that money back in. I'd then order a bit more stock and people would then circulate. Text messages moved into email. Emails became too much of a hack because I was just too much to-ing and fro-ing. I opened up a Shopify account, which was by far a great starting point, an entry point. Very easy, very easy to use, very easy to kind of manage. From a Shopify account, I moved on to a website. From a website, it moved from a Shopify account onto a WooCommerce site. Which made things quite a lot more technical, but it gave me a lot more freedom and scope to kind of move the website in the direction that it's going into now. So fundamentally, this is my form of income with consultations and educating people and making better choices with supplementation. It's not a shotgun effect. I'm going to take this and we'll see what happens. You know, let's fine tune in and see what's right for you. Let's make sure that the basics are right. I'm a very, very big believer in that. I mean, if we're not sleeping right, pooping right, training right, or moving right, 9 times out of 10, the headspace isn't right, which then no supplement underneath the sun is going to solve that solution. So I'm not a big advocate of pushing supplements. I'm a big advocate of getting the basics and making sure that everything's covered. Fundamentally, and then the supplements are an accelerator and enhancer of make sure that our health markers are staying optimal,
which is completely in line with my philosophy about
supplementation. That's correct. Yeah.
So basically, you started out selling supplements or distributing supplements from text messages to emails to an online shop, which grew from year to year, and now grew to the point where it basically allows you have sold your part in the gym.
Yeah.
And you now basically go back to being a nomad.
Yeah, that's right. Which makes me excited. Like I've ended my lease with my flat. I've got this opportunity to kind of have a big adventure. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm also extremely nervous, but that gives me that excitement. You know, not having somewhere to kind of feel that I've got the security pushes me further forward to kind of, all right, I'm in this corner. I need to make a decision, and this is what I'm going to do. So I'm super excited for the experience that I'm going to have in the Caribbean. You know, I'm going to spend a lot of time with JC Soane, which you're very good friends with. And then I'm going to spend a bit of time with Christian Maurice in Canada. And I'm very, very fond of him. Both people I'm going to try and sponge off as much as I can, and do a lot of training, like I said, do a lot of riding, and learn as much as possible, really. I in that present time, I will be taking the shop or taking the website into new directions, relaunching, reskinning as what I've been told what it's called. That doesn't sound as sexy as rebranding, but I'm super excited. So a lot of video content is going to be made, and again, more educational for people to make better choices and have a bit more of a grounding.
I've seen the first drafts and I really like how it looks.
Yeah.
And I also like the idea of making it like an educational platform that on top of the educational component just basically sells the supplements in the most thorough, precise and individualized manner based on the consultations you offer too.
Yeah.
Which is something that rarely happens with supplements. Most is like, okay, this is for that. Just take it. And then it, even in a very good case, it maybe works 6, 7 or 10 times rather than, okay, let's see, book a consultation first, then we'll look into, and then we'll individualize what I recommend you to take based on the individual assessment of the consultation, which is something that is also, which is fairly new yet. It's just another step in. When you look at 20, 30 years ago, it was like freaking your protein powder after training. You drink that, you're going to put on 15 kilos of muscle and
that's it.
To 15 years ago, the health supplements becoming more and more part of mainstream fitness training. Starting out with like vitamin D being the biggest one these days, a multi.
Yeah.
Magnesium, everybody knows about. Potassium, some know about.
Yeah.
Maybe even fish oil to some degree.
Yeah.
It just came into the level of health consciousness, whereas individualization is the next step. How much vitamin D do you need?
Exactly.
Do you need vitamin D?
Yeah.
For example, in the Dominican, when you talk to Juan Carlos about those guys that spend a lot of time outside, like, they've never taken vitamin D. They go get lab tested and their level is around 80.
Yeah.
So for them, supplementing vitamin D, no matter how good it is, you don't need it because your level is already optimal.
Exactly.
Or similar to omega-3.
Yeah.
Everybody that has followed my supplementation strategies and philosophy a bit more knows that I'm not the biggest fan of omega-3 in general. Omega-3 is an excellent supplement if you're actually deficient in omega-3s.
Yeah, yeah.
The three main reasons to become deficient in omega-3s is number one, not consuming enough omega-3s. Number two, consuming a lot of omega-6s. And three, consuming a lot of trans fats.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you look at nutritional habits in Europe, we're not the biggest consumers of omega-6 and we are not the biggest consumers of trans fat. So for us, the omega-3 needs are not as high as, for example, in North America, where refined plant oils, which are a big source of omega-6, as well as hydrogenated plant oils, which is a big source of trans fats, are consumed in a much, much greater degree. If you just read a research paper that's done in Tennessee, which is the worst state in the US, omega-3 is doing this, this, and this. But if you're coming from a place in Europe, preferably a place that has a very high level of food quality, for example, Scandinavia, and you read that and you expect these results,
it's not. Which you touched on, it's health and performance. Like I look at, and this is where I'm a big advocate about it, because performance is health and health is performance. And there's a lot of, like you started with protein powder, which is a classic example of what people would do. But the formality now is, I think, which is what we discussed previously, is about there is a movement coming, and it's already started with veganism. And so people will be coming health conscious. So there will be a lot more questioning about, you know, where people are sitting, in the sense of, which I think you probably missed out, was B vitamins, because that is kind of the one thing that people kind of harp on about, and where they get their B vitamins from. So I think initially it's that seed that's started, and what I'm going to be offering is corrective selection between performance and health, but I'm a very big advocate between the both. So health will increase performance, and performance is health. And understanding about, obviously, the same things what we agree on is kind of sleep, digestion, you know, and movement, getting all those three points right and understanding what needs to happen.
When I explain my supplement philosophy to clients, one point I often make is that basically performance is applied health. health is the base or optimal cellular function, which is one way to define health. If you apply that, that's when you get performance. So optimal cellular function needs to be the base of optimal performance. Optimal health needs to be the base of optimal performance.
Yeah.
To whatever degree the health point is. Especially one of the things lately, when we talk food, nutrition, health, and performance. A classic one these days is a vegan diet is great for athletes.
Yeah.
If you actually look at the amount of successful athletes and successful determined as how many win medals at world championships and Olympics, the amount of vegans is extremely low. And the case I like to make is, how about junk food diet for athletic performance?
Yeah, exactly.
As if you look at the actual data, there's the amount of athletes that win medals at Olympics and world championships that are on a junk food diet is multiple times the amount than the ones that are on a vegan diet.
Yeah.
So in that case, you could actually make a case for a junk food to increase athletic performance.
Which is very true. I mean,
which is absolutely true.
Yeah.
The most popular example that many have heard, Usain Bolt said that. Correct, in an interview. Yeah. He had two boxes of chicken McNuggets the day he ran 9.69, if I remember correct, in Beijing. He allegedly ate about 1,000 chicken McNuggets throughout those 2 weeks of the Olympics.
Which is crazy if you think about it.
One of the points with some example like that, is he eating like that at home? I highly doubt it.
Yeah.
If you look at Jamaican food, it's a lot of chicken, it's a lot of yams.
Yeah.
They have this like kalaloo, which is like a spinach-like plant. They have like ackee and saltfish, which is like breadfruit type of plant. So the level of the food quality they have, especially in the Caribbean, with basically three factors making food quality that's great. Very, very nutrient-rich soil with basically almost no modern agriculture, because they just cannot afford modern agriculture. Then second, a lot of sun. And third, a lot of water. It's also one of the reasons why, Dominican, one of the reasons you go is food quality.
Yeah, completely, which is a big, massive point in my life. You know, food quality is an essential. It's like, it's 101 for me, really. People often weigh it up in the sense, I'd rather put money towards my health, which is an investment, which I'd rather spend money on a good steak and a good piece of veg, than, you know, put money towards something else. I wouldn't go out, you know, putting money towards alcohol. That's just not an investment towards me. But this is kind of what we're talking about with regards to quality. Quality is a much better way to be looking at things over quantity. So, you know, the Caribbean is going to be offering me a lot, but you're completely right when it comes back down to athletes. I mean, you only see one slither of the pie, because almost guarantee you there's a lot more quality that goes into their lifestyle to give you that performance. So it's a little bit of an illusion that people are seeing only a snapshot of it. And it's also prior to people know, obviously, that people are not, with all the research that we see is, there have been meat eaters and they've moved into a veganism or a vegetarian diet, which has cleaned up their health markers, which is great. But then we need to kind of look at the longevity of that and if they're really excelling in excellency and performance from being on a vegan diet.
The big picture, which was my initial point with the nutrition, is just part of the whole thing of being healthy. And then looking at nutrition as a whole instead of just looking at a certain time. With veganism, one point I like to make, at what point is an athlete vegan? So if I win today gold medal at world championships at noon and I've eaten a vegan breakfast, am I a vegan athlete?
Yeah, correct.
I think the most people will say no. But then is my point, if I have eaten a vegan diet 3 to 6 months leading out to the world championships, yet the 10, 15 years before that, throughout my development as an athlete, I did not eat a vegan diet. I did an omnivore diet. Just the last 3 to 6 months before winning my gold medal, I had a vegan diet. Does that make me a vegan athlete?
Yeah. Well, this is all these question marks. This is people aren't seeing. It's seeing one snapshot. You know, they're not understanding the full story. And this is where it comes back down to studies. It's kind of, it's not thoroughly done enough. And like you said, it'd be pretty interesting to see if sticking someone on a junk food diet in relationship to performance before everyone goes out and eats chicken nuggets from to see if they can run a 9.8.
Yeah, and then seeing how How much of the whole food they ate over the last 20 years was that chicken McNuggets?
Yeah, exactly.
Because I highly doubt that Usain Bolt is eating chicken McNuggets on such a regular basis.
Which is just that thing. They're just trying to get as many calories as possible and perform.
And the number one, if I talk to the track guys, the German track guys I work with, the number one reason, McDonald's is the most popular restaurant in the Olympic Village.
Yeah.
Why? Because everybody knows what they get.
Simple, yeah.
So local food, some people are into local food. Like you travel to Asia, go to Vietnam, you try like do a street food tour and try all these different foods. Whereas an athlete, you've trained so long for something, you go there and you need a certain level of security.
Yeah, of course.
You don't want to go there and like eat on the street and then have diarrhea for the next 7 days and bump out a competition because of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think there's two reasons why something like McDonald's works so well. So I think everybody, including people that work for McDonald's, agree that it's not necessarily quality.
Yeah.
But there's two reasons why it works so well. And one of the two is because you exactly know what you get.
Yeah.
You know, if you go somewhere with whatever.
Which is a safety net, isn't it?
It's kind of China. You go there, you're hungry. There's 10 restaurants, 9 of them Chinese. You can't even read the menu. And there's one that's McDonald's. And you're really hungry. Where will most people go?
Yeah, of course. I mean, just...
Just because of that,
yeah,
you know what you get.
Yeah, but that's
it's roughly the same everywhere.
Yeah, security.
So it gives a level of security, especially in a scenario where security is as needed as the biggest competition of a 4-year cycle.
Yeah,
which is the Olympics. But back to food quality. You're a trained chef, and now you're basically educating people in nutrition.
Yeah, I mean, for me, food is like a no-brainer. Like, I cook every single meal, every single day, and it's like breathing to me. And I get that it's not as easy and simple for people, but it's literally about breaking it down as in what's realistic and sustainable for them to do. So I work through every meal, and I try to be as accessible to them as possible. So I might get a few messages that'd be like, okay, what can I do with this ingredients? And I'd be like, okay, this would be great. But it's about building trust and about people trying different things. Because, I mean, most people would probably agree they don't necessarily cook these days because they don't have time. You know, they confuse.
They do have time.
Huh?
24 hours a day.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not willing to take the time.
Well, that's it completely. They're not willing to take the time. Or I think people are more confused about food. They literally don't know what to eat anymore. We're confused about high carbohydrates, low carbohydrates, high fat, low fat, too much protein, no protein. So it's understanding about, and intuition is what I try to teach people. Like, how are you feeling? Does this make you feel good? Does it make you feel bad? You know, you bloated. Or simple stuff that isn't like a no-brainer between me and you, but it's getting them to start picking that out and educating them on getting a better result, because everyone's different. Everyone's sitting on a continuum. Everyone is, some people already like fish. Some people don't really like fish. Some people have a reaction to this fish. Some people don't. But it's about learning. But nutrition for me is 101. You know, it's understanding about, I need you to eat real food. All right, what's real food? Okay, and literally backtracking. It's quite funny. Someone told me quite a while ago, just, you know, you educate yourself and it's almost this knee-jerk reaction. Because you've learned it, you expect other people to go down that path and learn it as well. So it's almost it's a reminder every time I sit down with a client is that I got to teach them the stuff that I need to know, but in a basis that is acceptable towards them. Because everything can be overwhelming very, very quickly. So it's kind of about, okay, are you okay with cooking? Yeah, I'm okay with cooking. How many meals can you cook a week? All right. Realistically, I can only possibly do dinner. Okay. So how's about we look at doing breakfast? What's quick and easy? You know, what's realistic for you? Well, listen, I get up at 6 a.m. and I need to be out the door by 6:30. Okay. How's about you give me 5 to 10 minutes on some nuts that we've just toasted? You can throw some cinnamon in there or see what the missus can do in the evening. But it's a grounding point about what's realistic for them. And not setting up barriers too quickly, because the fundamental is I need to listen to the client, and the client will be like, listen, food's a no-go. But then you kind of need to go, okay, but you need to give me something. You know, if you're expecting to have change, something needs to change. You know, the definition of insanity is kind of like bashing your head against the wall and expecting not to be sore every single time. So nutrition for me is kind of like, it's a fundamental part where like, How much meat do you eat a week? Do you like meat? Do you like fish? Start with the basics. Can you grill? Can you poach? Can you, and season is a great stepping stone, because people often think, oh, I have to eat healthy. It's bland. It's horrible. It's too complicated. You know, I'd just rather keep something that I know that my mom taught me, or my wife showing me, or just something that is, like you said, a convenience. But it's just about putting that back in and trying to get people reinvested back into quality of food and a style of cooking that they enjoy, which often happens. Clients I've been with the last 3 or 4 years, if I pull back their stories where their wives wouldn't be cooking, and now wives are cooking on vegetables on the table, which is then integrating with their kids and changing their habits slowly but surely.
When we speak of vegetables, one thing that actually, the continuous glucose monitoring,
yeah,
that I've done for the first time like 4 or 5 years ago. At that point, there was no tool that was usable for clients, just on base investment. Back then, it was like a couple of days for 800 euros, like 4 days, which 800
is,
euros.
Which is crazy if you think about it now.
Ridiculous, huh? Whereas now you get like 59 euros. Mm. For 2 weeks, 24/7, measures blood sugar. And you were the earliest one that I knew that used the tool that I use these days. It's about 2 years ago that you actually put me onto it.
Mm.
And since then, I continue to use it with clients. And there's a lot of experiments going on. And when we're speaking of vegetables today at breakfast, you told me that you've done some experimenting with just basically grilled vegetable versus cooked and mashed vegetable.
Yeah.
And actually the same vegetable in two different preparation methods has shown different blood sugar response.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And this is when it comes back down to the style of cooking. Like, and it makes sense talking about it, but seeing it on a screen, on a monitor, kind of puts perspective with people. You know,
For all the listeners that do not know yet what continuous glucose monitoring is, it's a sensor that you basically put on the back of your arm, and it measures your blood sugar levels every couple of minutes, 24 hours a day. So you basically have an app if you have a phone, or you use a reader, which you can also get online, and it gives you a curve of how your blood sugar goes 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, sensorless 2 weeks. So you see exactly how you respond to a certain food or a certain scenario, or in the case of what we just talked about, also how a certain food is prepared.
Yeah, that's correct. So
there's a statistical analysis of how you respond blood sugar-wise to a certain food. It's a glycemic index or glycemic load. Huh?
Yeah.
Yet, as every statistic, it only counts for a general response. So we have outliers. Some respond to a much greater degree than the glycemic index says, and some respond to a much smaller degree than the glycemic index says. So another point with the need for individualization, or the big factor of individualized nutrition.
Yeah.
There's a lot of rules and a lot of guidelines, but they're just that, guidelines. You see some people, for example, that you were one of the greatest examples I ever saw with quinoa. Quinoa is a great carb as a general rule, but your blood sugar shot up to like 190 something,
which is ridiculous.
Which is, on paper, it's like, no.
Yeah.
Like, look at the research.
Yeah.
Glycemic index, it says, is a fairly good glycemic index. It does not lead to a great blood sugar response. Yet, when we looked at the individual measurings of you, your blood sugar just shot through the roof from eating quinoa.
Yeah.
So having these individual guidelines is good. But as with every statistics, there's outliers in both directions.
Mm.
We need to individualize to see how you respond.
Yeah, that's
Whereas
correct.
Other carbohydrates like rice, potato, and oats, you barely had any blood sugar increase.
Yeah.
And the same point with, I've done a lot of experimenting in the last 2 years. I've used it a lot. Yet that actually different preparation methods, I have not gone this far.
Yeah.
And really got me to think this morning when you said at breakfast that just having the same vegetable, one is just cooked and mashed, and the other one is just grilled, just put it through the pan, has a different response on blood sugar.
Yeah.
And some people will say, yeah, but vegetables, there's not too much carbohydrates in. I've had multiple examples of people eating tomato.
Yeah.
Which is basically a low-calorie, low-carbohydrate food.
Yeah.
And they had severe blood sugar response to eating tomato.
Yeah.
So again, if you look at science or research in general,
yeah,
tomato will not lead to a blood sugar response because it's low calorie, low carbohydrate food, which is true. The majority of people can eat tomato, no problem, no blood sugar response. I've seen multiple cases,
yeah,
that had blood sugar responses, and it's based on the individual measurement.
Yeah. I mean, it'll be the stress response within the gut. I mean, people's acidity levels and gut biome is completely different. And what I found super fascinating about the blood sugars is that with different cooking methods, it's the phase one's response towards insulin. So what we don't see...
Explain what you mean for the listeners, what you mean by phase one, and then obviously what you mean by phase two.
So what we see, what W's just explained with what the response that you see in the glucose monitor is phase two, what we're going to see, because you see a delayed response of 20 minutes of blood sugar. Phase one is what happens within the gut. Now, we have receptor sites within the gut that tell the body that we're actually having insulin that needs to be produced to response from glucose. There's two methods about that I found super fascinating. All right, if we inject a pure sugar solution into our bloodstream and we take the exact same sugar solution and we go through our mouth, our responses are vastly different. There will be almost zero response in phase one going through the bloodstream, and it'll be a much larger response in phase one going through the mouth. So what it's telling us is that our body prepares us for what we are about to eat, which comes down to quality of food, how we eat our food, preparation of our food with the cervelic phase. So cooking our food, it preps us, it allows us, it tells our brain, goes, hey, hold on a minute, I'm about to consume this lovely meal that I've just cooked. It could have been a steak, it could be potatoes, it could be broccoli, it could even be a cherry pie. But the point is that you've taken the time, your body's understood what's coming, you're going to eat it, you digest it, your body then preps the stomach, your then cephalic phase tells the insulin receptors and the glucose receptors within the stomach that there's, I need to prep the body to receive this amount of sugar. You then have a response, and then the response that we see much later on, which is about 20 minutes, is the rest of the bloodstream catching up to phase one. So what we did was we took broccoli, we grilled broccoli. You then see the response that you get from phase one towards phase two. You then took mashed broccoli that's been boiled, that's got a quite, it's not exactly nutrient dense or has a high profile of quality of it. And then you see a much larger response in phase two. So, because it misses out phase one. So that's kind of what we see from a theoretical point on a glucose response, where we see a much higher response, which means phase one from insulin and glucose hasn't been accepted. So your body hasn't prepped the response of eating food to the second phase. So when we see a lower response in our glucose monitors, we see a better response in phase one because the preparation's been a lot better. So if we take any supplementation or anything that's going to help with glucose, we normally recommend people, all right, you need to take it 20 minutes before because it interferes with phase two responses between insulin, which I find is super, super fascinating. So when you tell some people about how to cook, it's more about quality of the food, tasting the food. You want to make sure it doesn't lose its nutritional value. So keeping that in mind, it's a much further step with people that don't need to find time to cook, but you want to keep it in mind that they're not having rich, dense food and quality of the food, not having mashed potatoes and boiled chicken and where there's no exactly nutrients towards it. Yeah, I mean, I hope that makes sense to people. It's probably, if I had a chart board I could probably draw it and probably be a lot better in describing about how.
It's a very good point. In the end, it's just about preparing your food is part of digesting your food. Mm-hmm. And preparing your food is part of how well do you digest a certain food.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things that's often underlooked. People often think, where does digesting food start?
Mm.
It starts by chewing it, which is technically not correct. It actually starts by either seeing it,
correct,
smelling
yeah.
it,
yeah.
or just thinking about it.
Yeah.
The classic example of that, which comes from science, are the Pavlov dogs. which basically there's a Bing, they get food, and then they salivate.
Yeah.
And at one point, they just have that Bing beep, and there's no food, but they still start to salivate.
Yeah, that's
so right. Basically, they're conditioned to the point they know, okay, we have this Bing, and then boom, food's coming. So without actually seeing the food or having the food, they're already starting to salivate.
Yeah.
So just the association has an effect on how we digest food.
Yeah.
It's just like see, smell, think about. Everybody has watched some cooking show and got really hungry doing it. Yeah. Everybody walked into, you walk past a bakery or something like that has a really nice, like sweet, strong vanilla caramelish flavor smell.
Yeah.
And you smell it, you just get hungry. Huh? Right?
Yeah,
it
completely.
It happens. Yeah. Same as with just thinking about it, as the Pavlov dog experiment explained. So we prime ourselves to digest our food before we actually consume the food.
Yeah,
which is basically what's summed up in the phase one, phase two example you made.
Yeah.
That there's more to digestion than just chewing, swallowing, and then you absorb your food.
Yeah.
What comes before plays a role in how you digest or how well you digest and then metabolize the food, as blood sugar responds. Is more a question of metabolism than digestion, right?
Yeah, completely. And the point that needs to be pointed out as well is the surrounding. Like, it's such an crucial response to phase one that it will influence. Like, for example, we'll talk about the example what we did in the DR about
This year in February. Now we have December. This year in February, I have held a training camp together with JC Simo in the Dominican. Next February, we're gonna hold another one. You're gonna attend too.
Yeah.
And last year, 2 days before, we went up to the north coast of the Dominican, which is very little tourism, only small hotels, like 12 to 16 rooms and fresh caught fish and great produce. And the environment, it's just like, it's nature. You have kilometer long strips of beach with like 5 hotels in total.
It's like a postcard. It was like, it's insane.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like a Caribbean beach, how you think Caribbean beach is.
Yeah.
Not one of these concrete jungle, 500 bed hotels, all inclusive. The beach is packed. You go in the water and you see the sunscreen floating on top of the water, like nothing like that. A very like pristine beach, nature. How you think the Caribbean looks from a postcard?
Completely.
On the north coast, it's actually like that up there.
Yeah.
And we drove up there. We stayed the night. We spent the day on the beach, and then we had a huge dinner that night. If I remember correctly, we started out with some margaritas and appetizers.
Yeah,
two mains.
That's right. I ate for 4 people because I had the worst trip coming over. It was snowing. Like, it was no flights going out of London Heathrow. I was panicking. My taxi driver had cancelled. My original first flight was cancelled. I woke up at 4:30 to emails and phone calls from the taxi company that it's impossible. I then had to ring my friend that I knew had like a 4x4, and it was like, mate, you just need to get me to the airport. And he was like, it's absolutely snowing. I said, listen, this is a huge favor. You can ask me for whatever, and I'll do it. So he picked me up, rushed me to the airport. At this stage, I continued to kind of test myself out on the glucose monitor, which was on. It was through the roof, which is just in regards to the stress response. Got to the airport.
So your blood sugar was through the roof despite not eating any carbs, any sugar.
Nothing.
Just the stress response.
Just the adrenaline that was going through, yeah.
Huge, huge blood sugar level.
That's it. Got to the airport and I was like, she said, there's only a handful of flights on. I said, you're the first one to come and check. I said, what's the next flight towards Miami? Because I was going via Spain. She got me on the next flight to Miami. It was packed, the airport. You know, it's just like you see people in this, like, they're taking their clothes and then using them as pillows and that kind of situation. I hadn't eaten anything by then. I just had some water. I was like, all right, I'm physically, people that know me pretty well, I love, as you probably know from your head from this, I love food. So it's like, I don't want to eat. I'd rather not eat than eat bad food. All right. That's just kind of where I sit in life. So I eventually get on the plane. All I've got is aminos and some MCT powders to kind of get me through. I had that all the way through to Miami, which was, again, the worst experience of an airport going internationally. Don't ask me why, but in the sense that it was like people everywhere. It was disorganized. I was like, am I ever going to get to the DR? Get to the DR, managed to check in. I didn't eat anything then. Got to bed, got to sleep. You guys then picked me up the next day. We then drove to the part of the island, eventually sat down, had some food. We had this meal. I was consuming everything in sight. So JC was kind of like, oh, have this, have that. It was, so I had three starters. I had two mains. I had pizza.
Afterwards.
And then I had a couple of desserts, and we shared a couple of glasses of red wine. Went to bed, checked the glucose monitor in the morning. It like barely risen. It was like virtually impossible. It should have gone through the roof. The amount of calories that I ate, the amount of responses, and it was all majority like the pizzas. And I mean, I had potatoes, I had the polenta. It was a feast. There was nothing to say resembling that I had a worse response. Now, there's two ways of looking at that, you know, like, oh, I fasted the previous day and the response is invalid, really. But the way that we've always been looking at it is the surroundings of how we actually eat our food. Like, it was a relaxed environment. We were laughing our heads off. We were telling stories. We were in a situation that we're near the sea. You know, it was really a great memory that we kind of created. And that on itself is something that I've taken on, and I've told clients, and we've tested this out in the sense of, okay, don't have your meal. You're going to drive to work at 80 kilometers an hour, and you're going to have your chicken, or you're going to have your steak, or have your coconut yogurt or some nuts, and let's just test what your response is. To versus giving me 10 minutes at home, having something that's quick and easy that we've prepped the night before, and let's just test that out. So we try to get out as many anomalies as possible, and it's proven 9/10 of the time that the environment that set themselves of breakfast, lunch, and dinner sets them up much better in regards to body composition, brain fog, you know, digestion, which is a big point that I look at with people. There's so many key factors, but it's got to do about that phase one response. You know, how we respond to it is prepping ourselves for what we're going to eat, and then which gives us a dictatorship about, you know, the phase two, the way we digest, the way we process, and having, you know, getting more of our body. So it's, again, it's been a continuous journey to learn and test things out, and take that information and then test or share it with clients and see what their response is. But it is a completely individual principle. You know, it's something that I feel that we'll continue to learn. As you said before, quinoa was a horrible experience for me. Compared to white rice. So my body composition is hugely changed by integrating just white rice throughout the whole day. Like I don't eat a large amount of it, but I just interject it through. And theoretically, how it sits on a scale, it doesn't make any sense, you know? But
it works in your case. And also, I wrote your program throughout, and we did some skin fold measurement, and muscle mass went up, body fat went down, skin folds improved, especially the skin folds that are very sensitive to carbohydrate consumption. They actually improved despite you having more and more meals, which is odd. And before that, it didn't work.
Like,
before that, you would have 2-3 meals a week and your body fat would actually go up. So you are very fairly... low carbohydrate tolerance is part of your genetics.
Yeah.
Yet by adjusting it individually, you actually manage to eat multiple times a day carbohydrates with still great blood sugar.
Yeah.
But just timing, amounts, choices, and so on, which is a very, very good example of how nutrition needs to be individualized and how general rules are just that. They're just general.
Yeah, completely. 100%. And some people need to adapt. Like, I've had... One thing that I massively in health with, and I think I've spoken about it a few times, is digestion. Now, I had a terrible time with digestion in my teens and in my early 20s. It was something that was not apparent to me because it's something that you often don't talk about with people, or you kind of converse or have a beer or you do whatever and you go, oh, guess what? My digestion wasn't great today. It's just that doesn't really happen. But because I'm in the health sector and because I enjoy training people, you kind of learn as much as you can. You kind of pinpoint things. But ever since interjecting the carbohydrates that I did with, and just interjecting rice, by the way, it's just kind of like the most easiest thing to me to get done. my digestion has been on point for a very long time. So it's, again, not stressing the body out, you know, balancing things out in proportion. And the body's going, hey, you're doing a very good job here. I'm going to process everything quite nicely for you and make sure it comes out accordingly. So, which is, again, making everything move in the right direction, you know. It's which I'm a big believer, again, which we can talk about, is the gut and the brain and the gut, and which replicates towards sleep, which I'm a very big advocate of in regards to getting people to understand what quality sleep is. Because at the end of the day, people's terminology about waking up and feeling like, okay, this must be normal because I'm age 35, or this must be normal because I'm 46, or this must be normal because I'm 52. It's kind of like, it's not, it comes down to me to go, okay, I'm not telling you what's right and wrong, but I'll give you some facts and then you make the story up for yourself if you're having a good quality sleep, you know. One thing I think it's coming apparent is snoring. Diving into people, especially with couples, because I tend to work with a lot of husband and wives, partly because the husband joins up and he wants the wife to join up, or the wife joins up and the husband wants then gets joined, and makes the results happen a lot quicker. But one thing that's been apparent is sleep apnea, which is coming a big thing, and it's a very unknown space to find a solution. Surgery is one, and there's a few other things that I can't really discuss now. I mean, the formality of kind of finding a solution for it, but it's definitely something for people to be aware of and to go see a throat and nose specialist. And there's two tests that I can do, lying down and sitting up, and test the quality of breathing, because a simple change like that would change your body composition in getting restful sleep. And it's stuff that you kind of think about. Well, you think about it, but you think about it that it's a common knowledge situation, but people think it's normal. So a very good example is that people, like my mentors have told me throughout the years, is kind of the expressive cortisol. So cortisol is like putting underwear on in the morning. You realize that the underwear's on until you put another layer of clothes on. And what happens through the day is you don't actually feel your underwear, or you don't feel your clothes. And what that is in discrepancy with stress is that you completely just acknowledge it and you forget about it, it's even there, but your body is still being stressed. The exact same formality is sleep. So at the age of 35, you think, oh, this must be normal, when it shouldn't be normal. And if you get to 45, you're like, oh, this is only getting worse, but this is kind of what happens. If you don't address it, then it becomes normal towards you when you don't fix the problem. So it's simple tricks like that, just by investigating and asking people questions, that puts me down an avenue, which goes back right back to being, right, how did I become a PT, but now I'm talking about sleep apnea in regards to helping people out.
Sleep apnea is a big one, yeah. For all listeners. Sleep apnea is basically when you stop breathing for extended periods of time throughout the night. You actually don't feel it. And for a long time, sleep apnea was like, if you're severely overweight, sleep apnea is fairly common. But now we know, even if you're not overweight and not even that heavy, sleep apnea can still be the case.
Mm.
And not breathing for an extended period of time during the night actually lowers the sleep quality you have dramatically.
Yeah, hugely. It's just to point out, like, I got a... It goes in males and in females here. Like, I've got my husbands come up to me and say, listen, can you sort my wife out because she snores? You know, in this mentality that, can you give her something or refer her to go have a look at it? Because if it comes from me, it starts an argument because the wife doesn't believe that she snores. So it's very much, again, it's an educational point of view. So it's kind of like, okay, hey, how's about can we set up a recording system, which is apps on phones now that record sleep? And I'm not a big advocate about leaving mobile devices next to people, but if it's for an experiment to kind of see how things are, then it's quite good to kind of test the boat out on.
But then there's technological option that's actually not, where you don't need the phone next to you. I think the Oura Ring has changed to where actually the device records the data, and in the morning you take your phone and you read it out. So there's no connection between the device and your phone, so you actually don't need to have the phone next to you.
That's correct. So I've actually got an Oura Ring, yeah. And I think it's a very big thing. And it's a great investment, But it's like any form of technology. It's knowing how to read it. It's like giving someone the glucose monitor and saying, okay, this will give you, this is going to solve all your problems. It's like, if you don't know how to read it or understand what's going on, then it's just information that's useless. So the Oura Ring is a great piece of tech that I like to correlate with a glucose monitor. Putting those two combined can confirm things that, you know, isn't written down on a piece of paper by some doctor or some researcher, but we can take knowledge that I've learned and you've learned or other people have learned and put them together and test that theory out. So the Oura Ring, it's got a section of graphs which records heart rate and records, for the life of me, it's gone blank in my head, but there'll be a blank spot in the Oura Ring. And if you tap on it, it'll explain to you why there'll be gaps. But the reason for the gaps is kind of movement. So moving too quick in the bed, having kind of almost like a movement pattern that it will stop recording. But you need to think about it. It must be quite a big movement for the ring to stop working. And if you go and check the glucose monitor, you can almost guarantee that there's a low spike in regards to blood sugar. So your blood sugar drops that much that your body wakes up and needs to move and process, which I kind of use that information to kind of integrate, okay, we need to give you more carbohydrate, or we need to find out what's stressing your body out. We kind of look at Chinese medicine as well, which we kind of, both of us, we use a lot in the sense of understanding, okay, what time is your disturbance? Is it 2? Is it 4? You know, you're waking up super early. You know, what time do you normally wake up? If you're waking up at 7, but you're waking up at 5:30, what's that reason? Are you managing your stress too well? Not managing your stress that well. We need to look at cortisol or certain things, but it answers a lot of questions, but it's about reading the data and getting that understanding of that as well. You know, with sleep apnea and snoring, there's always a solution for everything, but it's just about understanding how to process it and how to get that done.
Very good point. I do use the Oura Ring with clients in one circumstance, when they come and ask me.
Yeah.
So as I do really like technology, I do not use a lot of technology for the exact same reason.
Mm.
Just using technology to gather data it's fairly useless.
Yeah.
You need to apply the results that you get from the data. So something like skin folds is the base of what I do.
Yeah.
Same as with you. And then of course, continuous glucose monitoring is a piece of technology that gives great data that can be easily applied.
Yeah.
And the Oura Ring is something that I actually do like, yet I rarely go that far as recommending it.
Mm.
In 99% of the cases, basically if someone comes like, hey, my sleep is, I found this, what you think? I'm like, get it.
Yeah.
Use it. But then be very thorough. I have their little testing protocol that you basically will try these things, we'll see how you respond, and then we'll adapt to improve your sleep quality.
Yeah.
I actually had an athlete I worked with for a couple of years. He used a lot of sleep supplements and improved his sleep quite a bit based on the reading. And then when he retired, he was like, "Nah, I'm not training on a high level anymore, so I don't have to take all these supplements." And within 6 months, actually his sleep quality gradually reduced again.
Mm.
He's like, "What's going on?" He compared data and was like, "Oh, I was taking all these supplements for sleep, and let's go. Let's see. Maybe it was that. We'll try again." He ordered some, and then within 2 weeks, his sleep quality was back to where it was before.
Yeah.
So it's a very simple using data as a feedback tool to see, okay, where's my sleep? What did I do? And then reintroducing basically something like magnesium increases serotonin production, which is precursor to melatonin. Melatonin is the hormone that puts you into deep sleep. And other micronutrients that are raw materials to make would put you into deep sleep, which is primarily melatonin.
Yeah. I mean, melatonin production, as we both know, gets started as soon as you wake up with a wakeful state to sleepiness. You know, people realize that it's a principle that happens at the beginning of the day. It doesn't go, okay, now the sun's gone down, I'm going to produce more melatonin, I need to kind of wind down. If you're a stressful person and you're in a stressful environment the whole time, you know, I've advised people to take magnesium right from the start of the day, in the sense of not just from a neuroactive perspective, but we want to saturate and produce as many hormones as possible in timing for you to get sleeping, you know, towards the evening. One thing,
but that's as a rare exception.
Yeah, yeah, that's the whole thing. It's not exactly like
there's exceptions too, where I recommend magnesium throughout the day. Yeah. But again, it's very rare exceptions.
Yeah, everyone's on a continuum. You know, it's kind of like we spoke about in this instance. There's a blueprint to everything, and then everyone follows it as an individual, and we can define what that individual. But that's the point about consulting. You know, in the sense of understanding what's best for them. I mean, one thing that's become quite apparent is trauma. An understanding about in regards to sleep quality and throwing supplements in and throwing everything, but people not understanding how their lives affect them for the result that they're going through today. And it's a big thing with psychology, and we're big believers in it, and all the mentors that I've worked with are big believers in it. And that's kind of where I talk about it with people these days, in the sense of kind of sometimes sleep quality is literally from an experience that they've are not finished processing. And what I try to get people to do, and I'm doing it a lot more often now, is getting people to talk to professional third-party people. And it's a simple thing to do. Well, it's not easy to do, but in the sense of we can talk about it, but getting people to actually go in and actually dig up information and get that out is something that's extremely hard to do. But the effects, again, it's a good, easy win without trying to find a protocol or a solution that needs to be covering up everything. So trauma in itself, if people are suffering from or suffered something in the past from that needs to be brought up, increases better sleep quality throughout the evening, which I found is a super fascinating thing to look at, because what we are as strength coaches and coaches, we want people to perform better and we want their health to be better. So it's almost like putting hands up and kind of going, okay, this is out of my realm. I would advise going seeing X, Y, and Z. You need to find what's appropriate for you and then come back to me a bit later when you feel a lot more settled. And that's, again, from taking data, so taking from a glucose monitor, taking from an aura ring, or just via the psychology of the person. You know, there's always a solution, but sometimes you need to think out the box. It's not about doing 10 by 10 by somebody who's going to get better sleep. You know, you can't keep on stressing people out. You kind of need to kind of suss out a better solution by getting people to kind of do different things and challenging themselves and get them to process. Because I'm not a psychologist and I'm not a person that is trained in that way, but if it's out of my realm with anything, then I just refer out as best as I can, you know. And I think it's important for people to realize that we're now in an age where there's a lot of accessibility, you know, from sex therapists to family therapists to even just talking to a best friend about it. It's something that I massively encourage because we're in a society that feels that we need to be internal, you know, being on a mobile phone all the time or being working all the time because we need to produce X, rather than trying to be self-intuitive and trying to look after yourself and actually get something out that you need to get out. I find that's a very good solution for people and a much quicker result in body comp, sleep, performance kind of situation, yeah.
The point I always like to make, if trainers that do my education program or clients come talk to me about the mental aspect. The mental aspect is probably the most powerful one that yet is, based on my definition of being a trainer, outside the realm of expertise as a trainer, yet needs to be addressed by everyone. Statistically, though, mental factors or psychological factors cannot be trained. Statistically speaking, because for the absolute majority, there's examples, there's people that make big jumps, but making a big jump in that realm is always based off being aware that there is the need or the potential for a big jump.
Yeah.
Yet when it comes to limiting psychological factors, most people are not aware that there needs to be improvement.
Yeah.
For most people, it's like, oh, it's like that, you know? People, especially when it comes to nutrition, even worse than training, the belief of what they need to eat and why are not they're not eating like that, and why they, because of that, not getting results. Most people are, to some degree, I would say, be delusional.
Well, it's expectations, isn't it? So it's kind of, and again, expectations are set by their surroundings. You know, we are who we surround ourselves by. You know, that saying goes, who we are by the five most important people that we read, you know, talk to, or even follow. So it's kind of, and then again, it comes back down to who we want, you know, spend our time with. You know, are we spending time with loved ones? Are we spending time with people that are going to influence in ways we don't want to? You know, people need to have a little bit more of a backbone. You know, I did a talk at a school with 1,400 boys, and I spoke about courage. And, you know, with my life journey, I've gone through some not so great things, but I had to make a decision very early on about, okay, I can either be cast out aside and being labeled this, or I can work my ass off and I can prove everyone wrong and stick a finger up and tell them, actually, you know, screw you. You know, you didn't believe in me. I'm going to prove you're wrong. But courage isn't, you don't suddenly wake up with courage. You know, I had to surround myself with choices and decisions that were, you know, put me in a bad position, but I had to learn from that. And that's what courage is. It's about learning. It's about growing. It's about dusting yourself off and keep on trying. It's like getting underneath that barbell, you know. If something isn't working under that barbell, find a solution, all right? Come off the barbell for a week or two and go back into it, you know. Do a quarter to the top and a quarter to the bottom. Do raised heels. There's always a solution for what you need to do. But courage on itself is developed over time, you know. And this is what we're talking about with the kids. Surround yourself with people you want to be around with. And it's not a social access to be on social media and feel like, okay, this is kind of where I want to be. That's delusional. You know, it's one slice of the pie. You know, after spending a bit of time in America over the last 12 months or so, it's really come to light how much you actually don't see and how much the social media aspect is so driven, but so falsified. What I mean by falsified, you meet people and they're completely different to what the aspirations are, what are on a social media platform. I'm like, how does that even translate to who you are? I mean, because it's just not a true aspect. It's like looking at the Mona Lisa and then finding out actually it's not done in paint, it's done in concrete. You know, it's just a simple realization, or you've been eating a lovely pancake that's done in this ingredients, but then you're finding out it's actually not. It's done in completely, it's just not, it's falsified lying. But people get sucked into that very, very quickly, which causes this trauma and this psychology, because the whole formality is people are always chasing something that is false expectations and setting this pedestal that is far too high. And not understanding what they need to do in a short-term goal to get a long-term plan, which is kind of, I know we just spoke about it in a roundabout way, but a coach these days is kindergarten. You know, we need to get a grade one, but we need to understand the responsibility about movement and understand about how to move people and get people to be healthier and to move better, to sleep better, to poop better, you know, and to have better mindset. But it doesn't happen over time. You know, it does happen over time. It just doesn't, you don't wake up with it. You kind of need to continue your journey and realize you're going to get knocked down and keep going. And clients are going to do exactly the same thing. But it's about being aware of that. And that what your scope is, that you, what you spoke about it's out of your realm. It is out of our realm. But it's our job to kind of go, it's out of my realm. Go talk to your mate this weekend, or go have some fun, you know, or go, you know, what do you love? Which is a very big question I ask clients. Give me three things that you love, and it can't be involved around money. It can't be something that is superficial. Yeah, give me three things that you really, really enjoy. And it's surprising. It puts people in a bit of a shock element, because it gets them to think. And it's not about drilling that into them. It's just about putting the seed in their head and seeing them change. It's the same, like if someone comes into the gym and they're meant to do a squatting session, or they're meant to do a chin-up session, and they've just come in and they've just come out of a four-hour meeting. Like, it's your due diligence as a coach and your responsibility. Okay, let's do some arms or forearms or some calves, or, you know, let's do some something that...
The shoulders, rotator cuff.
Yeah, but it's your due diligence. It's not to drill the guy. And it's a little bit of a bee in my bonnet. like metabolic training, like killing somebody at a training session. Like, you see one slice of the pie. This guy's got to perform. Like, most things are delusional with people and getting them to, like, crawl out of the gym. And I know some people feel like they need to go in and that's what they need to do, but it's our responsibility to educate people. Like, how many thyroid issues are we seeing with people versus stress? You know, we need to educate. By stressing somebody metabolically, it's not going to help their thyroid, which is not going to help their metabolism, which is not going to help them lose weight, which is not going to help them lose sleep, which is not going to help them poop better. It's a very vicious cycle. We need to know when to use our tools, you know, and that's where it comes. It's our responsibility to educate ourselves, test something out. Oh, that didn't work. Okay, I need to pull back. But it's intuition. Intuition is something that's not, you know, again, you don't wake up with it. You need to go and try stuff. So I go back to the terminology of the barbell. Learn something, practice something, move the weight to the other side until you got your 60 kilo and you can do reps of it. Get it right. Understand it. Process it. And that goes with everything we've just spoken about, the psychology, the food. Test things out. I mean, I didn't get to where I am, and I know you didn't get to where you am, knowing that everything that you believed in is exactly the same as it was 10 years ago. It's just that doesn't make any sense. It's a progress thing. It's kind of like test it, work it, understand it. All right, that didn't work as well. But it doesn't mean that doesn't work with that person, with another person that's going to happen, I'm going to see in 2 weeks' time. But it's intuition. It's understanding all these things. You know, I'm a very big advocate about life. You know, and I wasn't this person that's sitting on this couch and being able to talk to you about if I didn't understand what life is. I've gone and lived it, you know, and I made a decision when I was a kid, when I was being brought up, and understanding that I've got to make a decision to get to where I want to go. No one else is going to do it. No loved one, no mom, no dad, as much as they love you, as much as they want to care for you, at the end of the day, it's got to be up to you. It's your decision to like a photo, your decision to like somebody on social media or to follow or to make a comment, you know, that's not constructive to move people forward or to bring people down. It's kind of, all of this kind of situations is completely sold towards you. It's your decision about what food you eat. It's your decision about what time you want to go to bed, but it's your responsibility. There's too much shifting. It's too easy, you know, and I know it's much easier to talk about than to actually practice and do, but it's a decision that needs to be made. You know, what are you working towards? What are you moving towards? You know, what's the real picture? You know, if you're sitting in a desk and you're working your ass off for another company, but you really want to make ice cream. Okay, I'm not saying quit your job and go make ice cream, but you can stop probably making ice cream on the weekends because that's kind of what you want to do. And then if it really works out well, you could start, you know, selling ice creams to your friends. But you need to start somewhere. You know, moving the transition with the barbell. You know, you can't just go, right, I've gone from 60 kilos on the left to 60 kilos on the right. It's just not going to work. You're going to be too unbalanced. So if there's a few messages that have come out, and I know I probably get super passionate about it and talking about it, you've got to go live life. You're going to do what you feel is right, you know, but it's only up to you. Like we talked about a bit of psychology and trauma. A lot of people come out and they're scared about what their parents are going to think. Like generally, like I see a consult with a lot of older people. When I say older, in the sense of kind of, I go right up to the 60 bracket. And I like the term, I like the way that like a functional medicine practitioner breaks things down. We start from birth. And you drive everything to present day, and you literally, on a talking situation like we do now, not only exactly like a clinical board, you don't. I get them to talk to me about their life, as much detail as possible. You know, this is kind of we need to balance things out. And like, how were you born? And people are like, actually, I don't know how I was born. I say, well, can you just find out for me how you were born? I'm like, how did you go to school? Well, actually at 8, I was, you know, I felt like my mom told me that I was bullied. I actually got pushed down a jungle gym. Okay, I was just going to write that down. And then how was junior school or high school? Oh, I did fantastically well. Why was that? Well, I I was sent to boarding school, and I did a lot of running, and I got some friends around me and that kind of stuff. Okay, what did you do afterwards? I went to university. How was that? I had a terrible time. Why is that? Well, I just got huge amounts of acne. I couldn't socialize because I had to work so much, and then I had horrible digestion problems. Okay, how was your 30s? Oh, I actually had my appendix out. And so what I'm trying to get at is that there's always a story, and there's always something to kind of understand someone by. But I didn't pick that up. And I learned that, and I've interjected into my practice, and then I know a lot more about the client to start giving suggestions. And if it is out my realm, then that's when I need to own up and go, listen, hey Steve, hey Cindy, I suggest you go and see X. If you want to continue training, let's train. But I'm not, 9 times out of 10, I kind of needs to be what's realistic for them, and not unsustainable. I can't set them goals that are just completely unrealistic, but that's my responsibility. Like, I can't make Mark look like a 24-hour bodybuilder, and he's 45. And like, because he's got 2 kids. He needs to sleep right. He needs to manage his own business. Mark's wife, that needs to balance the whole household. I can't make her do a conditioning session 4 times a week that's 60 minutes long. And, you know, there's too many things that are going on. We've completely deviated, but I think the message I'm trying to get at is that I haven't been this person always, but I'm going to continue to challenge myself moving forward and learning and growing, and hopefully still spreading out the message that what we're talking about today. And it's just going to be a lot more richer. But it's up to people. You know, they need to make that choice. You need to start somewhere.
Right. It's a very good point. In the end, it's about evolution. Mm. So I think if we sum up the whole last 90 minutes, basically the last point you made is, when it comes to coaching, we need to look at it more holistically and more on a deeper level, especially at points where there's a lack of progress. If you're just doing simple things and you get a lot of progress, then keep going as long as you get progress. So if you, whatever, cut carbs, increase healthy fats, increase protein intake, get more regular meals, start moving more, start training better, improve your digestion, get the basics right, move progress. But at a certain point down the road, we need to look deeper.
Yeah,
you need to look more at the whole thing instead of just the 2 primary aspects, which basically every personal trainer, coach, or most people that are interested in this field look at, which is training and nutrition.
Yeah.
It goes far beyond that, which leads to the second point we talked midway through, the need for individualized nutrition.
Mm.
And nutrition needs to be individualized. But again, same thing, it's a hierarchy. It's a hierarchy of progression. If you go to school, if you go kindergarten, elementary school, it's the same for everybody.
Mm.
And the further you move up to school, if you do job education or go to university, the more specialized it becomes. So elementary school is the same for everybody. Like middle school in Germany, we have 3 different options. And then past that, depending on what your degree you get, there is hundreds of options for university study and job study. It needs to be individualized. Nutrition is the exact same thing. We have base principles, and then within these principles, we need individualization. If we take the example of blood sugar response to broccoli that's grilled versus broccoli that's cooked and mashed, there's individual responses to basically the exact same product it was in the beginning. And then evolution as a trainer, or evolution as a career, was the first point we spoke about with your basic history of working hospitality industry, then becoming a trainer, then opening your own gym, then doing the online store, and now basically fully focusing on the online store and going into making it like an education platform that also sells supplements, which basically offers consultations for potential customers to individualize what they're taking based on the consultation and assessment.
Yeah,
I think that's a very good overview. Anything you'd like to add, Ron, before I think it's time we get some lunch?
Yeah. Food. I just want to tell everybody, and if you want to stay in kindergarten, then stay in kindergarten. There's no problem.
It's fun times there.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Fun times. But that's the thing. Like, if you want to move, then move. But at the same time, if you want to stay there, then refer out. Like, if you would just want to do group training and you're happy doing outdoor group training and that's all you want to do and you're happy and you're content with that, then that's cool. But then don't falsify yourself and say that you're a strength coach and you're going to get someone strong by doing outdoor training and they're going to squat 100 kilograms. And that's when things get deliberately diluted. So it just so, hey, go see Steve or go make some friends that do strength training or go see somebody, you know, if someone comes in and say, oh, I want to run a marathon and you majority do, you know, Pilates, you know, go see Cindy. She does marathons all the time. She'll probably be your best advice. It's just about networking and understanding what you want to achieve. I just want to thank you very much for having the opportunity to come on and talk. I know I have rambled on a few spiels, and I just want to give thanks to everybody that's put me in this position today. I'm very, very grateful for the mentors that I've surrounded myself with. So I just want to give thanks. One thing that I has passed down that's helped me, and I try to pass it down to people, is kind of ask yourself some questions at night. You know, what are you most grateful for? What have I learned today? Who's helped me? Who have I helped? And what I tend to do is, if I find it quite hard to answer one of those questions, I try and make it in my subconscious for the next day to kind of make sure I have that fulfillment. It does set everything up quite nicely. And for a very long time, I'm a very big giver. I try to give quite a lot to people, and I couldn't find self-acceptance with me, allowing people to help me. So I always want to take the opportunity to kind of say that people that have brought me along my life have helped me a lot, and I'm very grateful for where I am right now. I'm super excited for the next steps that I'm going to be taking. Thanks, W.
Great last words. Rowan, thank you for being on the podcast.
Cheers, pal.